Hello, listener of the Third Sector podcast. This is Lucinda, and you're about to listen to episode 4 of The End of Charity, our 6-part documentary exploring the future for doing good. I hope you enjoy it.
The oceans are rising! No more compromising! The oceans are rising!
It's May 2018 in Stroud, Gloucestershire. Activists Gail Bradbrook, Simon Bramwell, and Roger Hallam have had enough. Climate change is spinning out of control. In the first 11 days of the previous year, the US state of California received a quarter of its average annual rainfall. Australia suffered through a series of devastating heat waves, and temperatures near the North Pole were more than 10 degrees Fahrenheit above average in winter. The three decide that drawing attention to the crisis is just not working. They want to lead a movement that takes a different and radical approach. The plan? Mass civil disobedience. The name? Extinction Rebellion. And the first major act of the movement? Stage an occupation of the Greenpeace offices in London.
We are doing this occupation of Greenpeace headquarters to ask you to take leadership on the climate breakdown and the extinction crisis.
You're listening to The End of Charity. I'm Lucinda Rouse. In this episode, we ask, as pressure groups for change, are voluntary organisations doomed to fail?
There's been a real attempt by some in politics to try and put charities in their place. We had that phrase from the charities minister about 10 years ago, who said that charities should stick to their knitting.
And does the complicated relationship between charity and the government help or hinder the sector?
There's no charity in the UK that's able to kind of point a finger at the Conservative government and say, you're killing people.
It was Extinction Rebellion that was first socialised, if you like, the use of the phrase climate and nature emergency. We weren't really using that phrase before then in the wider environment charity sector, and they made it right to do so. And that was a huge contribution. They definitely brought that sense of urgency.
This is Craig Bennett, Chief Executive of the Wildlife Trusts, one of the biggest players in the wildlife charity arena, speaking on the Third Sector podcast last year.
And I think in those first couple of years, a lot of the activities by Extinction Rebellion looked like something people wanted to be part of. They were very friendly and welcoming. It was good fun. And, you know, some of those first protests in London was something that kind of grew with ever more people getting involved, and that was really good. To my mind, that's a kind of indication of what those activities can look like when done well. You know, I fully understand, just when you look at the state of nature, you look at the scientific evidence about how serious the climate crisis is, I understand people's deep frustrations about trying to push it hard and trying to find other methods. But ultimately, we've got to use methods that work.
But why did Extinction Rebellion decide to go after a campaigning group that focuses on climate, and more of the radical ones when it comes to campaigning at that? If you listen to those activists who occupied the Greenpeace offices in October 2018, you can hear their motives loud and clear. The organisation was not going far enough. Their methods weren't working. Craig is part of a movement that is pushing for charities to have a louder voice in national debates and campaign harder on the issues they are trying to tackle.
I think what we have to do is, as charities, as charity chief execs, is tell the truth about what's happening in society based on science and evidence that we find and our experience as charity leaders about this is what's happening. And that's not a party political decision to do so. That's us sharing our information, our expertise and our evidence to help inform the public debate. And we should not be scared of doing that as charity leaders.
Tim Crosland was another founding member of Extinction Rebellion. When Third Sector interviewed him for a magazine feature 5 years ago, he said the movement had achieved more in its first 18 months than 3 decades of campaigning by established environmental groups. He believed the techniques charities used had become tired and tarnished, and their messages too simplistic. And when the Greenpeace occupation took place, it was in part because the chief executive at the time had refused to get involved in direct action. Janie Starling is co-director of the feminist campaigning organisation Level Up. Level Up is not a charity, but Janie previously spent several years working in the charity sector.
Direct action groups have the benefit of being administratively and bureaucratically unconstrained. So they can be very bold in their messaging. They can move in a very agile way. They can uphold more anonymity for the people involved. So people feel more able to take, you know, higher risk or potentially, you know, arrestable actions to make a political point. And they ultimately can be more courageous. And I think direct action groups do a fantastic job of shifting political discourse and putting issues on the table and keeping issues on the table that I think charities have struggled to do, just because direct action is very agile and you can be really creative with it and you can be really bold and you can ultimately, you know, disrupt. Charities are the opposite of disruptive.
On the 14th of June 2017, a fire broke out at the 24-storey Grenfell Tower in North Kensington. 72 people died, and hundreds lost their homes. For Janie, this was a turning point.
Yeah, in June of the Grenfell Summer Fire, I was working in the campaigns team at one of the UK's biggest housing charities. And when the Grenfell Tower fire happened, the organisation was really slow to respond. And I remember going over to one of the policy officers and saying, why haven't we said anything about Grenfell? And he just said, well, because it was a fire safety problem, it's not a housing problem. And to me, it was absolutely indicative of managed decline in social housing, how working class people, especially people of colour, especially, you know, migrant families, are completely neglected by the state. Housing is a sanitised and kind of shortcut way of talking about poverty in the UK, because if you're homeless and if you're precariously housed, it's because you really don't have much money and the state is failing you. But that's not how the organisation that I worked at saw it. And I just thought, hang on, well, if you're not going to issue a public statement on this because you're, what, afraid of challenging the government or you're afraid of falling out of favour with political stakeholders, then who are you here for?
Janie believes there are clear reasons why not-for-profit organisations might not feel able to share messages that run the risk of upsetting politicians.
Unfortunately, due to increasing regulation and restrictions on charity campaigning over, you know, the last kind of decade, they have been increasingly defanged and unable to criticise the state without jeopardising their own either funding contracts or kind of position as a charity. Where charity campaigning has gone wrong really is in the regulation of charities and in the regulation of charity campaigning, where they have on a welfare level become an extension of the state. But unfortunately, that proximity to the state means they're increasingly unable to challenge it. So they're unable to get to the root causes of the issues.
We've seen the blurred lines between charity and state before, particularly when it comes to welfare. Take the Trussell Trust. In 2010, the charity had around 35 food banks. By 2014, that number had jumped to 650. And today, that number has swelled to more than 1,300. And although the Trussell Trust is not reliant on government funding, failings in the welfare system have led to the explosion of food insecurity. The UK has also seen a rise in public service contracts that are outsourced to external providers, including charities. In fact, research from New Philanthropy Capital, a think tank for the social sector, recently reported that charities are subsidising government services by more than £2.4 billion a year. Not all charities receive their funding from the state, but even those that don't still face legal and logistical challenges as they seek to advocate for change. These include the Lobbying Act, or to give it its official title, the Transparency of Lobbying, Non-Party Campaigning and Trade Union Administration Act 2014. It sets a limit in periods before an election on what charities can spend on any public campaigning that could be seen as seeking to influence the election outcome. And some people, like our resident philanthropy expert Rodri Davis, think this legislation is causing overcautious charities to take a step back.
I think that there have been evolutions there in terms of the legislation. So there's legislation like the Lobbying Act, which governs what charities can do, particularly in regulated periods around the build-up to elections. And there have been other things like concerns about the introduction of clauses in government contracts that prevent organisations that are getting government money for providing services from also doing campaigning work. I think the real danger is probably less the actual impact of that legislation and regulation, because few organisations actually get caught by the legislation itself. What you tend to see more is the fear of falling foul of the legislation and the lack of understanding of where it applies, because it frankly is very complicated. Particularly, I mean, the rules around what you're allowed to spend on campaigning around elections are head spinning. And so that sort of leads to organizations essentially self-censoring, because if you're doing a calculation of, well, should we speak out on this issue? What's the benefit of doing so? Difficult to measure. What's the cost of doing so? Potentially very high. I think that kind of leads towards a much lower tolerance for risk for charities when it comes to speaking out. And that, I think, is a problem.
What's more, some sector leaders believe this is being compounded by an increasingly hostile atmosphere created by politicians and those in power. In the years since David Cameron's coalition government championed a vision of a big society, there has been a notable shift in the ways that politicians interact with charity.
And for those defending the broken system, the traffickers, the do-gooders, the lefty lawyers, the Labour Party, they are defending the indefensible. And that is something I will never do.
That was the former Home Secretary, Priti Patel, proposing an overhaul of the asylum system back in 2020. And it's this kind of rhetoric that charity leaders, or do-gooders such as Craig Bennett, are pushing back against.
There's been a real attempt by some in politics to try and, I'm sure as they would see it, put charities in their place. We had that phrase from the charities minister about 10 years ago, who said that charities should stick to their knitting. Really, we've come together to say a key part of the role of charities is to inform and help shape the national debate around a whole range of issues. And that actually that is part of our knitting, if you like. It always has been a proud part of the history of charities, is to shape and engage in the wider public debate. And certainly if we're going to achieve our charitable objectives, that's what we should be doing. We should be big and bold and confident.
Despite this chilly environment in which some charities may find themselves having to reiterate their right to speak up on these issues, many continue to exercise their campaigning voices, regardless of whether or not they are welcome at the table. The Trussell Trust is one such charity. Chief Executive Emma Reevey is using evidence they've collected about poverty in the UK from the front lines of food banks to engage in public debate and challenge those in power.
So for a number of years, Trussell has been compiling the data that's gathered by our food banks and then producing reports on what we're seeing on the front lines through our food banks, and then doing more in-depth research into what's causing people to have to come to food banks. We'd seen this steep exponential increase in the number of people coming to food banks, and we asked ourselves the question, is this it? Are we here forever? Is this just now a standard part of our society that people have to rely on emergency food aid to get by? And as part of our strategy development, we said, no, first of all, it's not right and it's not sufficient for what people need. And so working with policymakers, people in power, to help them understand what we're seeing, but also what those solutions might be that would mean that we wouldn't have to be providing emergency food aid. I think there's something incredibly powerful about charities speaking on these issues, because legally and entirely appropriately, we are required to be non-partisan. We are required to be non-party specific in requests that we're making. And although we're talking about political issues, we're not coming with any agenda other than to speak to the issues that we're seeing through the course of our work. What that gives us is the ability to enter into conversations and to be evidence-based. And when you start at that point, if you start on the basis of being evidence-led, but also with a willingness to work across party, across anyone who has any power to make a difference, then you can build consensus and you can build a collaboration cross party. We should be working with anyone who has the power to make a difference on behalf of the people we're serving.
The non-partisan approach may work for the Trussell Trust, but not everyone takes this view, particularly when it comes to the rules that prevent charities from taking a stand along party political lines.
One of the hardest things is that there's no charity in the UK that's able to kind of point a finger at the Conservative government and say, you're killing people. No charity is able to say that when it's blindingly obvious to everyone.
And why is that?
Because of the restrictions on charity campaigning and influencing. It would be a much more healthy democracy if civil society organisations were able to really challenge the state. And we don't have safe conditions for them to do that.
And remember, as well as the legal restrictions, there are lots of charities out there that also rely on the government to provide the funds they need to operate. Last year, the Trussell Trust received just 0.15% of its funding from the state. So does Emma think this has helped them take a stronger stance with their campaigning work?
I imagine that if one is in receipt of government funds, then there will be contracts in place and outputs that you have to be delivering, and you're co-producing a piece of work with them. I think what we're really clear on is that government funds should be used for social security, for household support fund. What we're doing should never become part of the fabric of the state, because we don't think it's the right thing. So that allows us to say this, don't fund this, don't do this, do that, support social security. So I think it probably does.
The Trussell Trust's food banks are performing a vital function in today's society, delivering emergency food aid to anyone who needs it. And their work has had a huge impact. Almost everyone we interviewed for this series made reference to food banks to illustrate their points on the role of charities and the direction the sector is going in. Added to that, the Trussell Trust receives very little state funding, and so it's in a strong position to campaign. And as it's filling in the failings of the state, little criticism comes its way. But that widespread recognition of the Trussell Trust's vital work is by no means the same for all charity cause areas. As Rodri explains, some areas are bearing the brunt of political opposition.
The most contentious area at the moment is probably around immigration, refugees and migrants. And, you know, you have to think there of, I mean, examples just like the RNLI, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, that have been very much dragged into this by doing, well, precisely what they're supposed to do, which is rescuing people who are drowning in the English Channel and other bodies of water. But that has essentially come to be seen as a political act because they've been dragged into the debate around immigration and are, you know, accused of making life easier for, you know, smuggling gangs and this kind of thing. And they have to push back on that all the time and say, well, no, we're just fulfilling our charitable mission. And the odd thing in that case is that, you know, they have to say, and their supporters often have to make the case, that if you see somebody drowning in the water and, you know, and you rescue them, have we got to the stage where that has come to be seen as something that is polarizing or divisive? And that seems remarkable.
And looking back 20 years ago, like, is it really very different?
I guess there's always been criticism of charities, particularly when it comes to the work that they do around campaigning rather than service delivery. So that's not a new thing, and I wouldn't want to pretend it is. I do think the level of polarization that we see at the moment adds a kind of new dimension to that.
Immigration is a highly politicized issue in the UK. So let's hear from someone working on the front lines of this crisis. The Refugee Council is a charity which supports refugees and asylum seekers. It receives government funding for its work supporting people entering the UK through safe and legal routes and those on resettlement programmes. It also works with local authorities to help children who enter the UK unaccompanied and are seeking asylum. But how does it navigate this highly contentious issue? Here's the Refugee Council Chief Executive, Enver Solomon.
Our issue is obviously one of the big political issues of our day. The issue of people coming across the channel in boats has become a hot political issue. It's talked about a lot in the media. It's talked about by senior politicians. it being such a prominent political issue and an issue that is very polarizing, we see that play out for us. So, you know, some of the comments that are made on social media can be comments that are quite aggressive. You know, where you have something that is very polarized, then the debate can become quite toxic and can become quite heated in the public sphere, whether that's on social media or in the broader public debate.
What about, like, are there been any like physical threats against your charity or the people working for your charity?
So we have had incidents where there have been things sent to our organization that have been perceived as very, you know, difficult and uncomfortable by staff.
And the Refugee Council is far from the only charity to see anti-migrant sentiment turn into hostile action. In November 2021, a group of fishermen gathered on the beach in Hastings to block an RNLI lifeboat from attending an emergency call while shouting anti-migrant sentiments. And in early 2024, 8 men were sentenced over their involvement in a violent disorder outside a hotel in Knowsley, near Liverpool, which was housing asylum seekers. Workers at the refugee charity Care for Calais were on the ground at the time. They described being trapped in the hotel's car park, surrounded by hundreds of far-right protesters who had broken through police cordons and were hurling rocks and fireworks. Thick skin is clearly needed if you work for a charity tackling an issue as polarizing as immigration. But like Emma and Craig, the Refugee Council's Enver feels that campaigning for change is a vital function of any charity and one that is respected in spite of the Refugee Council's public contracts, even if it's not in line with the government's policy direction.
And we also see, as part of our role, to use the evidence from our services to present that evidence to government. And sometimes that might be evidence that might be perceived as critical, that might be perceived as more challenging. But I think it's widely recognised by the Charity Commission and all those that understand the role of charities that it's part and parcel of their job to take the evidence from their frontline practice and to use that to make the case for change. And that's what we do at the Refugee Council.
Has there been any hostility towards your line coming from the Home Office?
So I think that, you know, it's perfectly understandable that sometimes we won't necessarily agree with what a Home Office minister chooses to do. But our role is never to personalise it, is never to get into a position where we're having a unnecessary public argument, but to position ourselves as presenting the evidence from our frontline practice to make the case for change.
We're in a year of political flux, with an election looming and a potential new government around the corner. I asked Enver whether he felt this could serve as a moment of reset, both for immigration policy and the broader charity-state relationship.
Well, I think it's particularly noticeable that we have one clear dividing line between the opposition and government, and that's over the Rwanda policy. You know, the government is committed to it. The opposition has said that it would scrap it. And I think that is a clear dividing line. And if the opposition were to enter government and follow through on that, that would make a significant difference. So, of course, there will be a difference. And I think that whenever there is a big political change, there may well be a big political change if there's a new government with a large majority, there's a huge opportunity for the voluntary sector to actually grasp that opportunity and to really push for change. But equally, there's a risk that it may not happen. So if you look at Scotland, for example, if you look at what's happened with the Scottish National Party, you know, I think a lot of the voluntary sector in Scotland thought that there would be huge social change, and there hasn't necessarily been. And I think that tells a lesson that just because you might have a change in government that the voluntary sector might perceive to be a more progressive government, it doesn't necessarily mean that there will be the progressive change you hope for.
But what about those charities attempting to create change on huge global issues such as climate change? Changes that could and likely will affect all of our lives. Is a new government enough? Can they really affect change by providing evidence to the state? Or are more radical tactics needed? Here's Rodri again.
particularly around issues like climate. I think there's a sense that maybe these issues have been around for quite a while and we've known about them, and there have been charities and NGOs existing to work on them, and yet we still seem to be where we are. So maybe we need to try something different and more radical. And if the charity model doesn't allow us to do that, and some of these new groups are able to engage in, you know, kind of tactics that demonstrate a stronger sense of urgency, then people are going to look to those models instead, I think.
I asked Rodri what he thought about groups such as Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion. Do they have the edge over climate charity campaigners?
There's a few ways potentially, and I know that they're, you know, the tactics that they use, groups like Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion, can be quite divisive, and you know, people have very different views on that. But in the way that they are able to engage supporters and offer them clear opportunities to participate actively, I think that's a real strength at a time, I think, where a lot of people feel as though the relationship they have with charities is a bit passive, and where, you know, they want to actually have some sense of agency in doing something about an issue. It doesn't feel like enough to set up a direct debit or just kind of, you know, give regularly to a charity and get a quarterly magazine. I think in terms of what those organizations actually do with the resources that they have as well, maybe there's a sense in which their hands aren't tied in the ways that charities are when it comes to things like direct action tactics, including, you know, deliberately kind of breaking the law in certain ways and civil disobedience, and where it comes to political campaigning, where obviously charities are limited by the law.
What does Janie think?
So many reasons why charities aren't disruptive. They are institutions and organisations that do move at a slower pace than a group of people who could decide today to block traffic in central London tomorrow morning. You know, that speed of decision making and the pace and the risk involved is something that any organisation would be very, very reticent to take on for fear of the long-term implications to their organisation. And by extension, if they provide services, they're service users.
Perhaps the bind for a lot of modern charities can be reduced to this simple tension. Too controversial for politicians, not controversial enough for some of their supporters on the ground. But here's something to bear in mind. 4 years after Extinction Rebellion invaded the Greenpeace offices, the group made a surprising resolution. In a blog post that declared "We quit," the group said that it would temporarily shift away from public disruption as a primary campaigning tactic. Instead, it would prioritise attendance over arrest and relationships over roadblocks. The group held 4 days of action at Parliament Square last spring, supported by organisations including Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace. Maybe the movement is looking to be a bit more charitable in its strategy going ahead. But why the change? Direct action had raised the alarm, Extinction Rebellion said. What's needed now most is to disrupt the abuse of power and imbalance, to bring about a transition to a fair society that works together to end the fossil fuel era. Yes, power. Who holds it? Who doesn't? And what can be done to disrupt those dynamics within the structures of modern charity? Join us in the next episode as we explore power in the sector.
We were dealing with a great British institution. It was a household name. It was going to be a huge story.
We'll be looking deeper into power imbalances between charities, their donors, and the people they exist to serve.
If they have all the solutions to my problems, who am I to tell them when I'm uncomfortable? Who am I to refuse when they call me into the room? Who am I to say something when I feel violated?
Who should have the power? And how do we, as a sector, give it to them?
We need to put the resources around it, and we need to structure it, and we need to protect it in order to happen.
The End of Charity is brought to you by Third Sector, the UK's leading title for the voluntary and not-for-profit sector. It was written and presented by me, Lucinda Rouse, and edited by Emily Burt. The producer was Ollie Peart at Rethink Audio. And special thanks to Rebecca Cooney, who devised the original concept for the series. We hope you've enjoyed listening so far. And if you have enjoyed the series, there are three simple ways that you could support us. Firstly, you could spread the word to others who might be interested in the End of Charity but haven't found us yet. And if you'd like to go the extra mile, Leaving a positive rating or review on your preferred podcast platform would really help us. We'd love to hear your feedback on the series. Thank you for listening.